I can't help it. We don't know how lucky we are. It really is wonderful. And I feel one of the luckiest ones because I've had a wonderful, charmed life here in New Zealand. And although on here I pulled out a knob, this I got for my 70th birthday. Not 70, 18 with 52 years in experience. Well, you add a few more years to the experience now. So it's a little while ago since I was 70. So my story is a long story. And I am going to talk in story tonight, and I think John Clark really started it well by telling a story. And part of the reason I'm saying it, that I see life as a story and a script, and we live it together with others on a world stage. So my story, and I am telling it because of a story, because of this book, which I have just got. Actually, I've got it before Christmas, but I've only just opened it in the bus yesterday. And it's called Extraordinary Anywhere, Essays on Place from Aotearoa, New Zealand. Now, it's a set of essays by different people. Some of the names you would recognise, some you won't. But I want to just read from the reason why the people who put these together were writing them. And it'll also explain perhaps something that's changed and you might not have noticed it in New Zealand and how we tell stories. Extraordinary Anywhere was first imagined in a July road trip between places. We took a break at Pai Kokoriki Cafe, the breathing sea, a presence just out of sight over the rise. We had recently met and had just swapped writing for the first time. Then we realised sitting in the warmth of that particular cafe in that particular place was that despite very different styles, we were in a sense trying to write the same essay. Both of us were writing in part about moving back to New Zealand. Now, I'm going to skip a little bit there. What we also realised that we weren't really trying to figure out what it meant to be a New Zealander, and nor were we particularly interested in the abstract idea of the nation. We were, rather, moved by what it felt like to live in particular places here in this country and in the intensity of feeling so many of us have about our various homes. We were struck by how many other people were also writing. And going down a little bit further, recent essays seemed to us to be taking different forms from those written by the likes of Bill Pearson, Bruce Jensen, or Sandra Coney in the earlier decades, which tended to address themselves directly towards the public domains of politics and economics. The change involved a shift in voice and tone and a foregrounding of the personal without necessarily relinquishing, big words get me, the desire to speak of and to the collective or public. We became curious about what these developments signaled about our current cultural moment and wondered what might happen if we brought some of these emerging conversations together. And this is what this book's about. I haven't read the story, but you can see what she's saying there. And it's extraordinary, and I'm going to say it extraordinary, because this is a little bit, this extra and super is where we are now in our whole society around everything. It has all become slightly hyped and overexcited. Now, just one little piece near the end here will say, for many Pākehā settlers and newer immigrants, the strength of emotion connected to New Zealand, to a sense of home here, doesn't find easy expression. Many of us are aware that not being tangata whenua means that we do not have a natural or prior claim on the place, and so there can be an obstacle between emotion and language. We find ourselves coming up short at times inarticulate. Can be hard to say what New Zealand means to us, to make certain claims about place without inadvertently displacing Maori, and so quite often place has been a topic to be skirted around. But nor should we assume that a Maori connection to a papakaranga or a home place is clear or easily expressed, even as we acknowledge an often violent and forced break in actual Maori inhabitation, yes, of particular locations. I didn't realise I had so many long words in it. There we go. So this is one of the problems that they were trying to address and that they feel is being addressed by this form of essay. And I'll leave it at that. because the next one I want to move to is that's the fact that I was born in Gisborne, but also I am a Pākehā New Zealander and have no Māori connections. So therefore, I'm in the position that it took me a very long time to find my place, my Tūranga Waiwai here in New Zealand. And that was given to me by, and I, wearing this tonight, this travels with me everywhere, by a most wonderful Māori woman. And I now feel at home in a way that it took me nearly 40 years before I was able to do that. Although my roots, on my father's side, I'm 5th generation New Zealander. But, and this is the other book that I have found and I want to recommend, Becoming Bicultural by James Ritchie. How many in the room, anybody in the room, know, remember Jane and James Ritchie at all? Yeah. Yes. And I bought this many years ago. It had got tucked away in the bookcase, and I just happened to find it the other day when I was coming to do this talk. And I read it, and I just realised this story is my story as well. And it is a story of how James came to understand how, as he said here, and this is why he wrote it, and that's why I'm calling this, I'll be using the personal I. This is a personal account of 40 years of change in the Māori world. For many years, I worked chiefly in universities, studying at arm's length in the academic manner what Māori people were doing within their own world as well as in the general society of New Zealand. From 1973 onwards, I became increasingly drawn into Māori concerns, etc. But I'll need to go on. Further on, you'll know there was a current debate on whether non-Māori people can or should do research in the Māori world. Most of this is just political rhetoric, but there are matters on which I would not work and on some to which I would not even ask Māori people to grant me entry. The notion of working alone is no longer acceptable to me now. I have come to adopt a research style, one that works for me at least, and I want to describe how this developed and what it comprises. And this is what he went on to say, the journey is a personal one, however, collective supports and settings. And so I make no apology for using my own pronoun. I begin with my 4 tapuwai and follow with 2 chapters which sum up my experience and understanding. Then follow discussions which will centre on my conviction that the future of Māori will be tribal. Finally, I close the book with a koha, a gift of return to the Māori people that I have worked with. This is my book, written for a Pākehā audience, but to promote Māori causes and purposes. And this is what I found. It's a wonderful story of the times that he was working, and a really worthwhile read. I can recommend it to anyone. With a bit of luck, you still should be able to find it in the library. So, as I said, I was born in Gisborne, oldest of 3 children, and actually just right at the beginning of the World War II, in November 1939. I first lived for the first 6 years in a small dairy farm run by my grandmother, because my grandfather had died when my father was in his teens, and we lived in an extended family at Whatatutu, and I went to, or just between Whatatutu and Pūhā, which if anybody knows Gisborne area, knows it's the dead end road that comes out from Te Karaka when you're heading north through the gorge. And when I was 6, the family moved into town, and I went to Mangapapa School, the Gisborne Intermediate School, the Gisborne High School, which at that point was co-ed until our 5th form, and then we had too many, so we split into a girls' school and a boys' school, and I did not like the girls' school. I was very pleased to get away. I decided I preferred co-ed schools. I got a post-primary teacher's bursary, we didn't have any money, but I was fortunate to be able to get a scholarship, university scholarship, and I got a B pass, failed in maths, but never mind. And I got a post-primary teacher's bursary. Now, how many of you here remember post-primary teacher's bursaries? Probably a bit long. I would never have gone to university. I was the first one in the family to go to university. And I came to Wellington because that was the easiest thing. I could get down here by train. 12 hours in that train, steam train, it was the first few times, I can tell you. It's quite character building. my choice of topics. I was, actually it was my third in the end. I got, master's, second class honours in chemistry. I really wanted to do maths, but I'd failed maths and scholarships, so I thought that's not too good. So then I tried geography. That looked interesting, and I was lucky there because I had the beginning of social geography, which was rather different to the earlier version of geography. And in the end, I ended up in chemistry because that's where I got my best mark in the end. But I don't regret it, and it turned out to be a very good choice because I also found my husband that way. I then, of course, was supposed to go teaching. But in those days, because if you get married, you don't have to go, you fulfil your bond. But I did feel a bit guilty about that. But I went and taught for a year at Wellington Girls College, so I can, and got thrown at the deep end with no training. I had a sixth form, a fifth form, two fourth forms, and a third form core maths, which just about killed me. But there we go, I managed it. But I did decide that teaching perhaps wasn't my forte, so I left it. And did it another way. Got three children and decided that, of course, I did want to be a mother. And we went travelling because in those days the university system allowed you sabbatical leave. The first trip was with just the two of us, was to Boston in Massachusetts, where I actually worked at MIT in the lab there as a technician, and was there when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I also saw the World Fair in New York just before we left, which was fantastic in 1974. So I saw the beginnings of IBM and the whole... I was probably one of the first people in this room who might have seen 3D or the attempts at 3D. Now, and then I'm going to leave it there because that gets me to 1982. Oh, I did have three children, three daughters. So we get to the questions I'm supposed to be answering. Why do we care? My short answer is that I care because I'm human and my experience of life leads me to believe that caring for each other and the planet has good outcomes for all. And that is the beginning, but tonight what I'm going to do is share my experience as a futurist and as a Christian that I think helped me find actions to take that show others that I care for them, myself, and for the healthy planet. Now, some of you managed to, unfortunately, it's lovely to see so many. I didn't have enough copies, but if you could look at the back of the copy, this copy of Future Times that you've got in your, you'll see there a lovely little cartoon comic of what a futurist does and what it doesn't do. So the picture of what my friends think I do, and that is sit in a gypsy box and tell fortunes. What society thinks I do is designing the next supersonic plane. What my clients think they do, I've got my crystal ball and my palm. What my family thinks I do is just a big question mark. What I think I do is replace fear of the unknown with curiosity. Is that time, 10 minutes? It does go quick, doesn't it? The future. What I actually do. And that, if you'll see, is putting missing pieces in a pattern. And so that's what I have done for the last 30 years. And the bit that I wanted that I haven't managed to put is my Christian part side, which is that I was an Anglican for my first 22 years, married a Presbyterian, so became a Presbyterian for my next umpteen dozen years. I've lost track. But now I worship in a small Trinity Union parish in Newtown, which is a Methodist and Association of Churches of Christ thing. So my background in that area is also a very busy one. I'm going to have a lot of this material around for you to better look at, and that's why I thought rather than talking too long, you can have a look at the stuff and I will actually fill you in with other things that you might need if you want to do. And to watch the space, I've got on here a T-shirt for the Living Economies. I'm working, these are some of the things that are coming up and I think are worth watching. The Wise Response, George knows that, and so does Russell. And I've actually known George because he was part of the New Zealand Futurist Trust, or the Commission for the Future, and I knew his work before he started and was part of the Futurist Trust. So I go to the United Nations Association and I'm working with them, working on the Sustainable Development Goals. I work for the Festival for the Future and Living the Dream, and that is young entrepreneurs. HUIA, Community Networks Wellington, Art Tech, Royal Society, Island Bay Residents Association, and so it goes. Sea of Faith and Ephesus. And there's a few more bags, and you'll see out the back also things there. Thank you.